getting beyond nuclear and other nasty fuels.
Get a moratorium right now on all new power generation facilities, which I think we should have. And instead took all that construction money and went through our entire system and upgraded efficiency, we wouldn't need any new power generating sources for a long, long time, if ever again.
That's solar power booster and anti-nuclear activist Harvey Wasserman. We air a 2009 interview with him about his book, Solartopia.
When we think about what is it that we need to do and sort of what is the reaction that we need to have as human beings to this crisis, I think it is, instead of getting so afraid about the future that we kind of stick our heads in the sand and don't look up, that instead what we really need to do is take that potential fear and transform that energy toward problem solving.
And that's Anna LaPay. Her book, Diet for a Hot Planet, is coming out in paperback this week. We spoke to her a year ago. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Riana. With a nuclear catastrophe in Japan still unfolding, isn't it time we get beyond nuclear? And the Deepwater Horizon oil disaster in the Gulf nearly 1 year ago made it abundantly clear that we need to get beyond petroleum, too. The goal of 100% renewables is becoming ever more possible. Recently, Energy Secretary Stephen Chu said that wind and solar are becoming cost competitive with oil and gas. And as early as 2009, Scientific American magazine devoted a whole issue to how we could have an economy that's powered by 100% renewable energy. We could have a solartopia. When we talked in 2009 with Harvey Wasserman about his book of that title, we were still hoping for a major climate agreement out of Copenhagen, a robust clean energy bill out of Congress, and a new president who would put clean energy ahead of nuclear, coal, and oil. None of that has come to pass. And as I've said often on this show, we're running out of time. If we don't start ratcheting down our carbon emissions by 2015 and get them down by 100% by 2030, we're in for hell and high water. Harvey Wasserman has a plan. His Solartopia is a world where nobody starves, there are no more wars for oil, education is free, agriculture is based on sustainable small farms, schools grow their own lunch and produce their own power, everything produced is recycled, mass transit is abundant, and solar housing available to all. And it's all done using technology we have today. Harvey Wasserman is an advocate for renewable energy. He's also been an anti-nuclear activist for many years. He sets his Solartopian vision in 2030. I asked him how we got from our current energy system to his Solartopia in such a short period of time.
Well, it wasn't easy. As you know, the Solartopia is dated AD 2030, although it could happen at any time. But we basically had no choice. I mean, we cannot continue the way we are doing in 2009. And there are 8 basic green steps to Solartopia, actually. We need to get rid of all fossil fuels and nuclear power, or what I call King Kong, coal, oil, nukes, and gas. We need to convert entirely to green energy, of course, solar, wind, tidal, geothermal, ocean thermal, and increased efficiency and mass transit. Mass transit being a big piece of it. Nobody's talking about mass transit. Really, we have to get off the automobile, which is the great ecological catastrophe of the 20th century, and back onto light rail and trolleys and intercity rail lines. We need to totally abolish waste and war. We cannot allow the manufacture of anything that can't be 100% recycled, and we need to, of course, abolish war. And right now, I think, at one of the critical turning points in the history of the country in terms of Afghanistan. If this administration is psychotic enough to expand the war in Afghanistan, then we are in very, very deep trouble. The lessons of Vietnam are so recent that the idea that we would repeat them in Southwest Asia is just astonishing, and let's just hope that that doesn't happen. We are still in this country, of course, devoting the vast sum of our treasure to military spending with or without Afghanistan, and that really has to change. All this debate about health care and so on would not be happening if the money, the resources from the military would instead be going to social services and to health care and to decent food and all that stuff. We need to also turn over all decisions about population to women. Women need to control how many human beings we have on this planet. Abortion, of course, needs to be legal, but I think more importantly, all forms of birth control, sex education, these things should be universal. And this is really is the province of women. Women have the power to find balance with the population on Earth. It's been found without much debate that where women are empowered, where they are equally employed and equally paid, or at least fairly employed and fairly paid and also educated, with complete access to education and have equal rights in the political system, that the population tends to level and even start to decline, which we need to have happen at this stage in history. So that's another critical step. The next step to Solartopia is changing, revolutionizing our agricultural system. We really need to go organic on a global basis. The use of pesticides, herbicides, chemical fertilizers, all that has to disappear. We cannot sustain chemical-based agriculture and or agribusiness, as it really is. Smaller farms and family-based farming is way more productive and manageable than large-scale farming.
Harvey Wasserman envisions aircraft powered by biofuels like hemp.
Air travel, actually, there's a lot of controversy over biofuels, and well, there should be. Ethanol and diesel, bioethanol, corn ethanol, but mostly is now, and biodiesel. These are being made with corn and soybeans, and that is not sustainable. We will have biofuels in Solartopia, but they will all come from non-edibles, what I call the incredible inedibles, especially hemp, which is staggeringly illegal in this country still, amazingly enough. And there will be other biofuel products, and these will be used primarily for air travel. I don't believe that the biofuels, liquid biofuels, are going to be a significant player for ground travel, for automobiles, for maybe for some forms of trains which run on diesel, but the key element, the key use of biofuels will be for air travel. It's going to be hard to have hydrogen-powered airplanes or electric-powered airplanes, but the envision of that I see for in Solartopia for air travel will be airplanes that, as they say, run primarily on biofuels, which can mimic kerosene, but done cleanly. When kerosene is the primary fuel for air travel now. And also the wings and the fuselage will be essentially covered with photovoltaic cells to provide electricity for the airplane, additional boost, and of course to power the air conditioning and the all the lights and all the other electrical units that go into an airplane. And there will be some hydrogen in mixed in with the biofuel to give it additional boost. So, you know, the future of air travel, I think, is going to change radically. In fact, they're already starting to use biofuels in some airplanes, and it's a good match, actually. It's a better match in airplanes, biofuels, or liquid biofuels, than in automobiles, because in automobiles, we really need to go to totally electric, which is much more efficient.
Now, totally electric means what? What's the source for the electricity?
Well, the source needs to be wind, solar, tidal, geothermal, and of course, automobiles will soon also be covered with photovoltaics. One of the keys to getting to Solartopia, to a totally green-powered Earth, is the massive breakthroughs that continue to occur almost on a daily basis with photovoltaic cells, which convert sunlight to electricity. And as the price of these cells continues to plummet, which it does every day, all our automobiles, all our homes, all our office buildings will be covered in photovoltaic cells or some kind of photovoltaic device. I mean, we're actually at the point now where we're getting photovoltaic paint, and glass is being made by incorporating photovoltaic properties, so that the glass we put in new buildings and which we replace on our old buildings will generate electricity, as will the paint. So You know, all the vehicles in Solartopia are covered with photovoltaics, and this helps operate them. But the primary electric source for our automobiles.
This is a very prosperous society. You're using, you know, hyper-technology, as you call it, to provide a high standard of living for all. And I just wonder, isn't that going to use an awful lot of resources? Where is the raw material? I've heard, in fact, Richard Heinberg talks about the fact that we're running out of, you know, the things that make computer screens or even the silica to make PV panels. So where are the resources coming from?
Well, there's two basic storehouses of pure waste that we will have to tap. And the first, of course, is military spending. You know, it's important to talk about how our resources are diminishing, but the fact of the matter is that we're still wasting $2 trillion a year worth of resources on war. And if the human society is to survive, war has to be eliminated. And I know that's a tall order, but, you know, it's one of those utopian ideas, but this is a utopian vision. And so the storehouse of resource that is set aside for war by a human society, that has to no longer go to war. It has to go to where it needs to go, which is to make life better for everyone on this planet.
And the other waste stream?
Is agriculture. The way we conduct agriculture is horrendously wasteful. We waste 90% of the grain that we raise in this country on meat. Now, if people want to eat meat, that's fine, but let's not be fattening these beef animals and pigs and chickens. All the corn, all the soy, all the barley, virtually all of it, goes to fatten beef animals. That has to stop.
And you also, in the book Solartopia, you also talk about radical recycling. So tell us, what is that going to look like in 2030? How are we going to recycle everything?
Well, Americans have shown that they will recycle with no financial incentive. Tens of millions of Americans every week put out their little blue or green containers for no economic incentive. But that's not where the key to recycling is. The key to recycling is at the front end, not at the back end. In Solartopia, it will be illegal to produce anything that can't be 100% recycled. You go into you go into a Walgreens or one of these other places where it goes as seldom as possible, and you buy something, you need a blowtorch to open the packaging on these things. I mean, it's just staggering. And so, the amount of waste in the society really is based on commercial considerations and nothing to do with the Solartopian vision of the world. And what we need to do is have laws in this country that prevent any corporation from making anything that can't be easily reused. Plastic needs to be done away with in favor of cornstarch and these other, biodegradable products. And everything like that has to be a change at the front end. Automobiles. If we're going to make automobiles, they need to be 100% recyclable, as is happening in Germany with Mercedes. You know, you can't, in some instances, you can't buy a car in Germany. You have to lease them. And when you're done with it, you turn it back in, and then they take it apart and reuse everything.
And I'm speaking with Harvey Wasserman about his book, Solartopia, which came out first in 2006 and has been updated. Now, what about efficiency? You talk about how in Solartopia, the very first thing that happened was efficiency. Give us some examples. Make this real for us.
Well, this is actually continuing to be the issue. I mean, everybody's fighting over nuclear power now, and all these roadblocks are being put up in front of wind and solar. But the fact is that increased efficiency is still around 2 to 3 cents a kilowatt hour. If you had a moratorium right now on all new power generation facilities, which I think we should have, and instead took all that construction money and went through our entire system and upgraded efficiency, we wouldn't need any new power generating sources for a long, long time, if ever again. Look at LED lighting, for example. LED lighting, which is much, much better than compact fluorescence, by the way. Way more efficient, way more usable. Mass transit is part of it. We really need to get to mass transit and to people love trains in this country. You know, this whole idea of the Americans' love affair with the automobile is a myth. Everybody loved trains. We all had mass transit in every city in the country. You never had to own a car. Everybody got around great. And that has to be reconstructed. Our homes, our offices, our factories still remain incredibly wasteful.
Now, you talk about some things like proton palaces and floating gardens. Could you tell us what they are in 2030 in Solartopia?
Yes. Yeah, so I posit in 2030 that we will have large offshore wind-generating facilities. And this was the idea of University of Massachusetts professor William Hieronymus, who, you know, made the first drawings for really, really large turbines on platforms out in the ocean. And this, of course, is starting to happen. There have been big fights, of course, over the Cape Wind project, but off of Cape Cod. But clearly, along the oceans, along the coasts, and in the lakes, by the way, and actually one of the first offshore places where there will be a large wind array will be Lake Erie, outside of Cleveland and Detroit. So in looking at these platforms, it occurred to me that they could have multiple uses. And so each of these platforms in Solartopia has large wind generators, and then underneath they have ocean thermal facilities where you tap the temperature differential between the surface of the ocean and the depth of the ocean where it's very cold. The surface of the ocean, of course, the water is heated by the sun. It's a form of solar energy, and this ocean thermal technology has been proven and is certainly workable and economically viable. And then we raise a fish in an open situation where instead of having massive contained pens where the fish are fed chemicalized feed and given antibiotics and the whole deal and are stuffed into very dirty conditions, what we do instead is have open fish farming where we simply feed fish that come by and, you know, make sure that the ocean has been restored, the oceans have been restored to health, which I think we can do if we stop overfishing and stop dumping chemicals and so on into the ocean, then of course all our trash. And so this is combined further with photovoltaics and other solar arrays. And we also raise algae on the structures, the supporting structures of the towers. And I think that algae is also potentially a very significant player in the biofuel business. There are a couple hundred, at least, different species or forms of algae. And when we get the right ones, we're going to be able to raise, I think, significant quantities of biofuel. The basic inputs for algae are water, carbon dioxide, and sunlight. And these are, of course, in great abundance. And we may be able to generate some hydrogen there as well. Those are the elements of these massive sort of offshore power-generating facilities that are hybrids and have such a great mix of different facilities.
Now, you envision an array of this kind extending from New England down to Argentina?
Yeah, sure, all along the coast, on both sides, also from the West Coast. And all around the world. It's starting to happen. There are also, by the way, undersea facilities with I won't call them windmills, but they're underwater blades is what they are, really. There is one been installed in off of Norway, and essentially it's a windmill that's put into the ocean currents. You know, the water, of course, is way more dense than air, and currents are more reliable than the wind. And so if we can solve the deterioration problem with salt, the corrosion problem with salt, we can have windmills under current mills is what I call them, actually, underwater.
Is this what you call?
Those can be very, very productive in terms of various forms of power.
Is this what you call water worms?
Yes. Sorry. The tide mills are and the current mills are for underwater. We will be, of course, harvesting the tides as well. But the water worms are for waves. Those are wave generators. Now, they've started to come into being too, and they're among my favorite, actually. They look like giant sausages. What they are is big, big tubes with, you know, essentially two moving parts. They're hinged. These giant tubes are hinged, and they float, and they bob up and down with the waves. And when they bob up and down, they squish water through tubes that go onto shore and create electricity or other forms of energy. Or harvest it from the sea. They're extremely efficient and very, very cheap because they only have two moving parts, basically. As I say, it's a hinged kind of sausage that sits out in the tides and bobs up and down. there are various forms it'll take and various technologies will be used, but they'll all be very, very simple. The only ecological problem we see is that we expect teenagers to go out there and paint graffiti on them. But other than that, there doesn't seem to be much impact.
Now, you also talk about a solar New York. Talk about what the cities will look like. Of course, this is also going to mean a kind of end to sprawlburbia, which you say, in spite of the fact that we're going to have cars. So talk about the relationship between city and suburb and what the great cities are going to look like.
Well, the studies have come in now pretty reliably and with some frequency that people who live in New York are actually the most energy-efficient people in the country. It's a walking city, and you know, there still is a mass transit system there, and not that many people in New York, or a smaller percentage of people in New York own cars than pretty much anywhere else, and that's true of all the cities versus, you know, the suburbs. I mean, the suburbs are a disaster, and the whole concept is a disaster. What we should have had, and this was a decision still continuing to be made, you know, suburbs are still continuing to be built. The alternative vision was to have an inner city, a center city, surrounded by green space. And there are a couple areas, Boulder, Colorado, that did preserve some green space. But I live in a town, Columbus, Ohio, where we watched them rezone ag land, you know, time and again, all these gorgeous farms that were in the Ohio countryside. And then one after the other, whenever a suburban developer would come in, they'd just buy the land, and then they'd go in and get it rezoned. Whereas if there had been a total moratorium on rezoning, the cities would have grown up on the inside, and we would have had energy efficiency. So the suburbs are going to be abandoned. Right now we have whole suburbs which have been emptied out.
But tell us what New York is going to look like in Solartopia 2030.
Right. Well, and once the drain of the suburbs is stopped, then the resources go back into the city, as they are doing in New York City. Now, New York City, the city itself, does have mass transit. Buildings are being built in New York City that are more energy efficient. In fact, there's a development, Battery Park City, has been used, or is being used, for the world's first, you know, solarized urban development. It's a very big deal. It's called Solaire, S-O-L-A-I-R-E. And gradually, building by building, the buildings in New York City are becoming more efficient, and new ones are being built slowly, but they are being built with solar and with geothermal. I think the great symbol is the Citicorp building, Citibank. It has a wedge. It was designed, you know, with a giant wedge on the top. I'm sure most people are familiar with the building. And originally, they didn't think of solar. They had the wedge was, I think, facing west, and then just before they got it under construction, or even while it was under construction, I'm not sure, somebody said, hey, why don't you flip the thing around and face it south and put photovoltaics on it? And they did. You know, I think it cost like $80,000 to redesign it, and now the wedge faced south.
That's
and
great.
So then there's the Condé Nast building, which is downtown Manhattan, which is being built with solar, or has been. And there's also geothermal being used in New York City, in Manhattan. So I think a lot of since there's still some money in Manhattan that Madoff didn't take it all, you're seeing architectural changes in New York that are encouraging. Now, in Solartopia, of course, New York City has become a zero-waste place. There is nothing since it's illegal to produce anything in Solartopia that can't be recycled. Everything in Manhattan is recycled in New York City as a whole. And the buildings have all been made energy efficient. They all have switch-off lighting. The windows are all solarized. Everything's painted with photovoltaic paint. The mass transit system has been upgraded. Cars are virtually banned. It costs you a fortune to bring a car into Manhattan and other parts
and
of the city.
And can we grow our own organic building as well? I mean, that's a very intriguing
idea.
Well, yes.
Now, one of the things in Solartopia that happens is there's a conversion to bio-construction materials, especially bamboo. Bamboo is extremely strong and very long-lasting. Bamboo actually compares to steel in its tensile strength. And so we have, wherever possible, grown our own building materials. And, of course, everything else is recycled. We do have plenty of materials to recycle for a long time to come. But also, you know, because population has leveled out in Solartopia, we do have less demand for new buildings, and most of it's basically about conversion. But there are bio-building materials that do come into play in Soartopia.
And also, I noticed that you make reference to these large solar arrays, but there's also this other model, which is C-BED, the letter C-BED, Community-Based Energy Development. So you talk about Windiana and C-BED. Tell us about that.
Well, Windiana is the Great Plains area, which stretches really from, to a certain extent, from the west side of the Appalachians to the east side of the Rockies, but most importantly, just west of the Mississippi and the wind belt of from North Texas through Oklahoma, Missouri, the Dakotas, Minnesota, Kansas, Nebraska, Iowa. All those places have tremendous wind resources. And what we want to do is basically capture those. Now, even at this point in time, there's no excuse whatsoever for building anything west of the Mississippi that's not solar or wind power. The wind resource in the Great Plains is so enormous that at this point in time, with available wind technology, we could generate three times the electricity that the United States uses with available technology. Just from those areas, we could do 100% of the electricity that the United States uses now just from the wind resource in North Dakota, Kansas, and Texas, and not even all of Texas, primarily just the Panhandle and some areas in West Texas. So the technology is available, and Windiana, this great area where the winds don't stop, could provide all the electricity for the heartland, and it should be community-owned. Now, when we had that's an important piece of the solar.
And what does that mean? What does community-owned mean? Spell that out.
Well, community-based energy development basically is that involves farm ownership or landowner ownership, community ownership of the wind resource and the windmills. Right now what we have is large corporations going in there and building wind farms, that are owned by the corporations, and the corporations profit from these. And what we really want is to have farmers owning this wind resource and communities owning it. And this is happening with the C-BED model, where communities, and this is a critical difference, because we see corporations going in and dominating the wind resource, and to the detriment of the communities. It needs to be community-owned. We don't need large corporations coming in to do these technologies, to do these green technologies. Instead, they should be owned by the community, so they're truly green, they're truly communal, and they will truly advance the vision of a just world, because we're not going to get to a green-powered world that's not just. Social justice has to be a part of the Soartopia vision, because it won't happen otherwise.
I just want to ask you one last question. You mention gardens floating in the air. Is that right?
Well, yes, in the trees and in the... because there are many plants that can grow with air and water, and among them algae. And we, of course, floating on water, as I mentioned, we'll have gardens around the wind facilities. But basically, gardens will float in the air, but most importantly, on rooftops.
I see, yeah.
On the tops of buildings.
Yeah.
And that's what I'm really thinking about. And when we start our Soartopian flight in our HPV bio Soartopian airliner, or hairliner, as we call it, because of the hydrogen, we look down on Copenhagen. We've taken off from Hamburg. We take off from Hamburg because Hamburg was the first city to have a hydrogen filling station. In 1999, actually, they opened a filling station where you could drive in with your hydrogen car and get a fill on hydrogen, and that was, a big deal. As we fly out of Hamburg over Copenhagen, we look down and we see that many of the buildings, all the buildings have either photovoltaic cells or gardens on the rooftops, or both. And buildings in cities and in homes and so on can and should have gardens on their rooftops, because, shingles such as we have now are incredibly wasteful. But the bottom line is that many, many, many buildings around the world have rooftops which are very, very well suited, not only for photovoltaics, but also for gardens, and that we can put good soil up there and raise crops, and at the same time insulate the buildings so that they're warmer in the winter and cooler in the summer.
Well, it's a wonderful vision. The book is Solartopia. It's available as an ebook as well as a print book. And we'll go out listening to a song by Pete Seeger, written especially for the book. Thanks so much, Harvey, for talking with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Was there an Adam? Was there an Eve? Or did we evolve from what we conceived? Either way, we got what was needed when the sun shone down on the Garden of Eden. Don't you know we're gonna have a solartopia, solartopia, solartopia. Don't you know we're gonna have a solartopia all over Gatsby.
Welcome back to Writer's Voice, airing on this station and at writersvoice.net. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Our food system is a major contributor to the greenhouse gases that are playing havoc with the Earth's climate, from cutting down forests for farmland to raising meat animals in huge industrial operations to the thousands of carbon-spewing miles our food travels. The connection between the environment and food was first brought to public awareness by the mother of my next guest. That was Frances Moore Lappe, and her hugely influential book was Diet for a Small Planet. It advocated vegetarianism as a healthy, environment-friendly alternative to the predominantly meat-heavy diet Americans followed. Now her daughter, Anna Lappe, has come out with Diet for a Hot Planet. It's about creating a climate-friendly food system that's healthy, tasty, and sustainable. The book is published by Bloomsbury Press, and I spoke with Anna Lappe at the publisher's offices in New York's historic Flatiron Building. She starts her book out with a visit to a meeting of farmers in New York State, where they've just been told that if we continue on with business as usual, farming in New York in 2050 will be like farming in Georgia now.
And that room full of farmers, literally, you could hear the audible gasps in the room as farmers imagine what that would mean for them. Everything from what that would mean in terms of the expansion of pests, because they can overwinter much more easily with these more temperate conditions. And so this would be a huge increase in the number of pests spreading, especially into latitudes where we never found them before. We know that even at the current increase in temperature that we've experienced because of global warming, we're already seeing more extreme climate events, as they're called. So those are hurricanes and floods and droughts. And we know what that means for our cropland, that will dramatically impact our crops. And the predictions about what that will mean in terms of overall global food yield are all over the map. But one thing we know for sure, that there will be a dramatic impact on how we farm and what we farm if we don't radically change course and really rethink the amount of emissions that we human beings are currently putting out there into the atmosphere.
Now, I'm from New England, and we love our maple syrup. We love our dairy farms. We love our apples. Are they going to be possible by 2050 if we're on this trajectory of climate change?
Well, I mean, all those things you just described, I mean, you talk to anybody from any region, and you could sort of think of any region in the world, and we all have those foods that are close to our hearts, right, that we know to be the foods that are native to our region. And that's because for a significant portion of human history, there's been a relatively stable climate. And so you have emerged these certain products, the maple syrup in New England or the citrus in Florida, that have adapted to that climate. And so what we know for sure is that what climate change means is this such an undermining of this stable climate that we have gotten used to, that we certainly can expect to see a lot of changes to what we can grow and where we can grow it. And so I think that when we think about what is it that we need to do and sort of what is the reaction that we need to have as human beings to this crisis, I think it is, instead of getting so afraid about the future that we kind of stick our heads in the sand and don't look up, that instead what we really need to do is yes, understand the gravity of the climate crisis to everything about what we've known to be the sort of creature comforts for humanity, including primarily a stable food supply. We need to understand that gravity, but also we need to take that that potential fear and transform that energy toward problem solving, toward a kind of energized population that starts to see how we can actually do something about this. And that's what I'm interested in sharing in the book.
And you sound like your mother, Frances Moore Lepay, when she talks about getting a grip.
Yes, absolutely. My mother and I have been now almost a decade of colleagues, as well as mother and daughter. And we certainly do share this outlook and around kind of how to relate to a planet that is in such crisis. And I think a lot of people are surprised when they hear us talk, because they say, well, you sound so hopeful. You know, how can you be so hopeful when everything we know to be true about this time is in some ways so grim? And both of us had a really life transformative experience together about 10 years ago when we set out to write our first book, which we ended up calling Hope's Edge. And that life transformation experience was that we came to understand hope in a radically new way. And how we came to understand it is that for the journey to write that book, we met some of the most courageous social movement leaders on the planet, facing some of the biggest obstacles you could imagine. In Brazil, they were landless farmers who were up against landlords that were unwilling to give up their land. 1,000 members of this movement had been killed in the process of trying to transform land ownership in Brazil. We met farmers in India who were facing incredible droughts and were facing epidemics of farmer suicides, farmers driven so desperate by debt that they were committing suicide in the fields by drinking the very pesticides that had so indebted them. So here we were meeting these people who were literally on the edge, and yet were part of social movements that were trying to get at the root causes of these problems, the root causes of land inequality, the root causes of hunger, the root causes of indebtedness among farmers. And they were also some of the most hopeful people we had ever met. And so we started asking people where they got their hope. What was the source of their hope? And what we heard across the planet in every language, from Kiswahili to Portuguese to Spanish to French, Polish, was we heard people say again and again that hope for them did not come from the conviction that they necessarily would win. It didn't come from this easy calculation of, you know, can we prove that we are making things better or are things getting worse? Instead, it was inextricably tied to the process of taking action. And so they said that hope for them was more, as we put it, more verb than noun, and that we become hope as we take action. And so I think that I like to translate that lesson about hope to this new work I'm doing around food and climate change, which is to say that by taking action around trying to change the path that we're on away from this climate instability and toward climate stability, that in the process of taking action around these issues, we also find ourselves becoming hopeful.
It's a tall order sometimes, but your book, Diet for a Hot Planet, really gives a lot of wonderful principles, and as well as examples of how people are putting those ideas into effect. You talk, for example, you take on the term sustainability. You say it's become a buzzword, and you say instead we need to talk about climate-friendly agriculture, not sustainable agriculture. Talk about the difference. Why are you driving toward the idea of climate-friendly versus sustainability?
Well, unfortunately, the term sustainable has really been picked up by a lot of companies, agribusiness, that I wouldn't necessarily define their practices as really embodying what my principles of sustainability are. So I went to industry conferences where the chemical agriculture companies were saying what they're doing is sustainable, because you just need to buy their chemicals and you'll be able to sustain your farm.
Monsanto, for example, I think has an ad like that.
Monsanto has an ad like that. Syngenta talks about sustainability, and all these virtually every agriculture-related company, whether you're talking about from the chemical side, bioengineering side, or the grain trading side, they've all created sustainability departments and sustainability reports. And to be clear, I'm not saying that it's not important for companies to be thinking about improving their impact on the environment, but I think we really need to be careful about how we're defining our terms, and we really need to be watchful about what these companies are actually doing and not let them just get away with writing a 130-page sustainability report and actually not addressing the underlying destructiveness of their business practices.
In Diet for a Hot Planet, Anna Lepay says the industrial production of meat contributes heavily to climate change. Thousands of animals are raised in so-called CAFOs, confined animal feeding operations, where they're no longer eating food from the farm. It's being imported, and their waste is concentrated in huge polluting lagoons.
This move internationally toward taking livestock off the land where they have evolved, consuming, for instance, ruminants like cattle, evolved to naturally transform grass, which we humans can't eat and get any protein out of. Ruminants historically were able to take grass and turn it into high-grade protein for human consumption. That taking that potentially very sustainable process and putting it into confinement, it concentrates a whole range of different problems, including the problem of waste. And so in the book, I talk about the connection between CAFOs and climate change a lot throughout the book.
This is Writer's Voice, and you're hearing an interview I did earlier this month with Ana Lape about her latest book, Diet for a Hot Planet, The Climate Crisis at the End of Your Fork, and What You Can Do About It. We spoke at the offices of her publisher, Bloomsbury Press, in New York City. You bring up the example of Tyson Foods, I think, which is getting a subsidy from the government for a green operation of using this waste. And talk about that and talk about some of the problems that you've discovered with it as well.
Right. So one of the examples I use in the book is an example to tell the broader story of how companies, food companies that are now realizing they're in the climate seat hotspot, are trying to get kind of credit for in terms of public perception, but also credit for, in terms of subsidies, actual dollars for going quote-unquote green, going in theory green without actually changing the underlying impact of their practices. And so the example I use in the book as one of them is Tyson Foods, a large poultry producer in this country. They have initiated a partnership with a fuel company where they're building what they are calling renewable fuel plants. And so the one I mentioned is this one they're creating in Louisiana. And Tyson says that this plant is going to be a quote-unquote renewable fuel plant because they're taking waste from their factory farms, so excess bones and other animal byproducts and bedding that poultry lived on, so that includes excrement, all kinds of waste from the factory, bringing it into a plant, mixing it with fuel, and out at the end comes what they call this renewable fuel that's going to be used. It can be used in highway transportation and airplanes. Critics, though, of this so-called renewable fuel say, well, actually, if you account for that full life cycle of the fuel, there is no way in which you could call it sustainable or renewable because there are so many emissions, so much energy that gets wasted in the process of creating that meat that it doesn't make up for it and then using a bit of that waste for this fuel. But also in interviews with folks that know how this fuel burns, they also communicated that it's not as if this fuel is burning any more efficiently or any cleaner than the fuels that we currently power our cars with. So not only does the process of making the fuel have to be accounted for, but also it's not like this is cleaner burning fuel. This isn't beneficial to the environment in any way. So I use that as an example of the way that companies can be capitalizing on our concern about climate change without actually addressing it. And I'm all for creative ways to think about how we handle our waste. But the question we need to ask is the move toward these kinds of operations, which, as I mentioned in the book, are being heavily subsidized by our tax dollars. The move toward these kinds of operations, are we essentially incentivizing a kind of production that is so wasteful and then dealing, being a little bit more creative at the end with that waste? And what I suggest is we need to back up to the very beginning and say, be asking the question, should we even have CAFOs to begin with? And if we ask that question, we could talk about how we could produce this food without producing that kind of waste, without using the kind of energy that we need to use to then end up with those byproducts.
There are people who counter the whole idea of organic agriculture, of small-scale agriculture, by saying, well, that's all well and good for people who can afford it, but we cannot feed 9 billion people on this planet, which is, what we're trending toward, without, the pesticides, without these CAFOs, without industrialized agriculture.
There's a couple ways to think about that question. First is this cost question. If you look at the breakdown of where our dollar goes when we spend money on food, you see that in a lot of cases, less than 10% of our dollar is actually going to the farmer who raised the food, whatever that food item is. And about 3/4 of it goes into the packaging and the marketing and the transportation and all these other aspects of our food, which isn't actually even the food itself. And so I think you can make a pretty strong case that even if it were a little bit more expensive to farm organically, primarily because our organic farmers aren't getting the kinds of taxpayer subsidies that our non-organic farmers are getting, so it's a bit more expensive because they're not being subsidized, that you could argue that the overall end price that we consumers are going to have to pay or should pay at the end, it's not actually going to be a significant portion of that dollar that we're spending money on, because so much of our dollar is going to things like marketing these products to us, like the overhead to the CEO of Kraft that's getting the tens of millions of dollars a year that he gets, and to so many things that I would argue are superfluous to actually providing us nourishment. The second thing I would say is that we have very good evidence now that's from studies all around the world that have looked at yields on farms that are not using chemicals, that are not based on fossil fuel overuse. And we're finding that yields are as good or even better than the farms that are using these industrial processes. And that might come as a shock to a lot of us who've been sort of raised with this idea that, you know, we absolutely need these chemicals to survive. But what a lot of those who argue that case don't acknowledge is the very good evidence that, yes, shifting to synthetic fertilizer or agricultural chemicals, when farmers first move in that direction, they can see a big increase in yield. But what happens over time is that the soil that isn't getting the lovely treatment that it gets with organic farmers who are building healthy soil, that soil is getting depleted. So the microorganisms and all the things that really provide health to our plants gets depleted with synthetic fertilizer. So over time, you have to add more and more and more fertilizer just to keep up. What they don't acknowledge is pesticide resistance. So you're using pesticides, and the more you use pesticides, you have this evolutionary biology paradigm that's very well documented, that pests start becoming resistant. And so then you have to increase the amount of pesticides you're using. And so when you talk about productivity, you talk about feeding the world, I think that we need to look very clear-eyed at the full story of our current food system and the way in which, yes, we're getting high yields, but we're getting it at a very high price. And that price is the cost of increased synthetic fertilizer use, increased pesticide use, the loss of topsoil, that soil we need to grow our food, the loss of water tables because chemical agriculture is so water dependent, and of course this cost to our climate. I mean, we're not going to be able to feed the planet if we have a completely unstable climate. And to the extent that food is a contributor and industrial agriculture is a contributor to the climate crisis, we're actually undermining our very ability to feed ourselves the longer we resist moving in the direction of organic and sustainable farming.
We're talking with Anna Lappe about her latest book, Diet for a Hot Planet. It's about agriculture in a time of climate change. So give us maybe the Cliff Notes version, the brief version of how is agriculture contributing to climate change?
Well, first, the big picture is that by many estimates, the indirect and direct contribution of the food system, global food system, to climate change is about 1/3 of all emissions. And a big portion of that, about half of that, is coming from rainforest and forest destruction that's being driven by agribusiness. And so one could say, oh, well, that's the forests that are causing, or the loss of forests that's causing climate change. Well, I think we need to ask the question, well, who's destroying the forests? And once you ask that question, you realize that there are a handful of agribusiness companies that are directly involved with forest destruction to make land to grow crops. Some of those crops are ending up in fuels, these biofuels that you see a big push for in this country and in Europe. Some of the other crops that are being raised are going to feed livestock, not human beings. So there's a big push among agribusiness companies to put a lot of pressure on our forests, especially in Latin America, in Indonesia, Malaysia, that really impacts our ability to have a stable climate. So about half of it's coming from that deforestation, that really serious deforestation. And then the other half of it's coming from the whole range of processes that are now a part of our industrial food chain. A big factor is this industrialization of livestock production. So animals used to be a very sustainable part of the food chain. They used to be a vital part of the farm, providing manure that would help fertilize the soils, providing muscle for farmers to get that energy they needed on the land to plow the fields and that kind of thing, providing, of course, milk and other forms of food sustenance. And now this industrialized model is taking the animals off of the land and putting them essentially into effectively animal factories that require enormous amounts of energy to heat and cool and ventilate, that also contribute to other emissions from the waste coming out of these concentrated waste coming out of these factories. So livestock alone, the livestock sector, is about 18% of global emissions, which is more than all transportation combined. And so what I'm arguing in the book is that as we think about how we solve the crisis, we need to really understand what are the biggest drivers behind the crisis. And I think we've really effectively started to communicate the need to question our coal-fired power plants, to put the oil industry on notice that they really need to shift away from certainly offshore drilling and getting oil from all kinds of other ways. But I also argue that we need to talk about food, and all sectors need to be a part of looking at where their emissions are coming from and how they can reduce them.
Now, you give a number of ingredients. You say that there are five ingredients of climate-friendly farming. You take the example of a farm that you visited in Wisconsin, the farmer Mark Shepard. I'd like us to go down these five ingredients because I think that they really provide a very comprehensive, a kind of systemic view of what you mean by climate-friendly agriculture. So the first one is nature mentored. What does that mean?
Nature mentored, it means that we have a lot to learn from nature and that there's an inherent abundance to nature and an inherent synergy in how crops and I don't even like to call them pests, you know, let's call them insects and pollinators and I don't like to even call them weeds. You know, farmers like Mark Shepard don't talk about weeds. They talk about the ways that different plants can be symbiotic with each other and in a sense create a community on the farm. And in order to have that nature mentored approach to farming, though, requires an entirely different view on what it means to be a farmer. And it doesn't mean planting 1,000 acres of corn and checking the calendar and seeing if it's the right day to spray. It means actually looking at your land. It means actually thinking about where you are in the country. And so Mark spent a lot of time before he planted anything studying the history of his region, figuring out what grew naturally there. And it also means seeing yourself not as a master of your farm, and you know, you look at these pesticide names, and they're called things like Avenger and Target, and you know, these very kind of militaristic kind of names. And instead, he described himself as a population manager. So it's really about bringing the right kind of mix together of both bringing in the right insects and the right animal mix in with the right plant mix and doing things like planting perennials and annuals. And so on his land, what you see is you see plants of literally every shape and size growing. So you have trees that provide the right shade cover for the kinds of mushrooms that grow well with those trees. And then he brought in the shrubs that grow well next to those trees. And you see a kind of symbiosis where these plants are really helping each other out. And it's the kind of plant population you find in nature and you find in forests. And he's bringing that back to his farm. And of course, with an eye to what can humans eat. So there's a lot of food coming off of his farm. But it's really done in a way that, as he says it, he has to do very little work. He's a population manager, but he spends a lot of time sort of sitting back and watching what emerges. And a lot of trial and error. And over 13 years has completely regenerated these fields from soil that was virtually dead soil that needed synthetic fertilizer to grow anything to soils that are, you know, you drop seeds in them and it just, you know, like he said, you barely have to do. I mean, he kept reminding me, it's not like he doesn't do any work. He's one of the hardest workers I know. But in order to get that kind of abundance, there's a way in which he says it, you know, nature wants to grow and wants to reproduce and wants to create the kind of abundance that he certainly has on his farm.
what you're describing is permaculture.
That's right. So it goes by lots of different terms, and permaculture is one of them. And it and one of its principles is this biodiversity. The other principle is this mixture of perennials and annuals. And so thinking about the long term, you know, what can you plant that, that grows again and again and again year after year? And then what do you bring back? What are the annuals that you bring in every year?
We don't really have time to go into all of these ingredients. You talk about restorative and regenerative, and I think you just talked about that in the sense of regenerating the soil. Talk about the last two, resilient and community empowered.
These are all, I would say, kind of equally important and really support each other. And this idea of resilience is particularly key because even if we were to tomorrow wake up and have had some global epiphany and cut back our emissions to get to a place where we have 350 parts per million of carbon dioxide equivalent gases in the atmosphere. We're at about 390 right now. So we not only do we need to stop emitting, but we need to actually be pulling emissions out of the atmosphere. So we know that we are going to face more droughts and more floods. We're going to face more climate instability. And the kind of farming that I talk about in Diet for Hot Planet, this farming that is nature mentored, that is bringing in natural practices and back onto the farm. What it is also doing is creating more resilient farms because it's creating healthier soil, and healthier soil produces stronger plants. Healthier soil is also more able to act like a sponge. So during times of flooding, instead of the soil being so vulnerable, it just gets eroded and washed away. It is like a sponge that's able to hold the water and actually therefore provide for the plants when they need it.
And how much of this, you know, the last one is community empowered, which I find very apt for your work and also your mother's work. The community empowerment is a very important element. How does that come in here to create a resilient, climate-friendly agriculture?
It's absolutely, absolutely key. And it's key because what we've seen happen is so much of our food chain, from the seeds, who owns the seeds, to who owns the land, to who owns the processing plants, the grain processing, the meat processing, it's gotten concentrated into the hands of just a few companies globally. I mean, we can name them. It's Monsanto, it's DuPont, Syngenta, Cargill, ADM. We can name them. There aren't that many of them. And these are companies, most of them publicly traded, that are driven by their bottom line, which is they're showing profits on their quarterly returns. They're not driven by what are the choices for long-term climate health, long-term human health. And they are not accountable to us. They're accountable maybe to their shareholders, but they're certainly not accountable to you and me, to our communities. And so time and time again in the book, I give examples of how communities have been impacted by these global multinational companies and have had to fight for years, for decades, to get any remuneration for water destroyed or soil depleted loss of human life. And so what I talk about in the book is that as we think about what is the system we need to do, the sort of scientific system that we need to be fostering around what is that agricultural science look like, you know, and what does organic farming look like and why is it better? Yes, we need to build those arguments, but we also need to couple them with what's our economic argument about what is the kind of economic system that we need and what is the kind of corporate accountability that we need? What are the kind of regulations that we need to put in place so that all companies are held to a standard that promotes human life and climate health? And so we have to bring that economic conversation in, that corporate control, essentially, conversation into the story as we talk about what is the best science for feeding the world. And that's where this fifth principle of community-empowered farming comes into the story about what it would mean to have a truly climate-friendly food system.
Diet for a Hot Planet, thank you so much, Anna Lepe, for talking with us here.
Well, thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Anna Lepe is also the author, with her mother, Frances Moore Lepe, of Hope's Edge and Democracy's Edge. Diet for a Hot Planet is just out in paperback. I talked with Anna Lepe 1 year ago. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net for more about today's shows. You'll find links to more information, web-only features, and you can sign up for our podcast and get connected on Twitter and Facebook. Thanks for listening. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.